This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're looking at an issue that is affecting people across New York State. Leaders from organizations that provide services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities say that they are dealing with a staffing crisis. Direct support professionals provide assistance to people with disabilities, helping them live and work in their communities. And leaders say there was a staffing shortage prior to the pandemic. Most of the time that's due to funding, usually inadequate funding levels at different levels. When it comes from federal, state, et cetera. But now we're in a crisis point. In this hour, we are talking about the role of direct support professionals, the state of staffing for their field, and the impact that the shortage has on people with disabilities. And I want to welcome our guest, a distinguished panel who is going to get us up to speed on what's going on. Marissa Geithner is President and CEO of Heritage Christian Services. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Pat Demento is here. Pat is a direct support professional with People, Inc. Hi, Pat. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us on the phone is Angie Perez Delgado, CEO of Ibero-American Action League. Angie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Dawson.
Kevin Scott, former direct support professional and now staff member at Ibero-American Action League. Kevin, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Meyer is a project administrator at RMAPI, the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Rebecca, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just kind of take an overview of what DSBs do and sort of the state of things right now. And let me start with Marissa Geithner. Tell us what DSBs do. Let's start there.
Direct support professionals are the heart of any service. In the serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, they're most often referred to as direct support professionals, and they are the front lines providing the day-to-day care that individuals need. Most times that means not only helping them through their day with tasks like freshening, using the bathroom, showering, but on most days they aspire to be able to help people really achieve goals, learning and growing, being an active and integral part of their community, and just ultimately achieving their goals.
I'm looking at some of the numbers here. The New York Disability Advocate Surveys finds that currently in New York State, one in four, just under 25% of positions are now vacant. And that is a survey of 118 different provider agencies. So we're talking big, big numbers here. And I'm curious to know if that's exactly what you're experiencing. I'm going to ask all of our guests to sort of take us through what they're experiencing, and I'll start with Marissa.
It is what we're experiencing at Heritage Christian Services. Our staff vacancies are about double what they were prior to the pandemic. And again, not a new issue, as you mentioned, Evan. We've seen the care gap for years, knowing that the number of people in our country needing care is escalating and the people providing the care is flatlining, but that's been magnified by the pandemic.
And is the trend line moving in a direction that is only worse, or do you see hope for this?
It is at this time moving in a direction that is only worse.
Okay. Let me ask Angie, as the CEO of Ibero, what are you seeing right now?
Oh, yeah. We went into this pandemic at a 38% vacancy rate, and currently we're missing half of our workforce. We've become dependent on other means of securing staff, but I agree with Marissa. This is not getting any better for us.
And let me ask Rebecca at RMAPI, how do you see this? How serious is this right now?
Yeah, so for RMAPI, we see this as a question of wages across the board. We know that direct support professionals and many other service and nonprofit and health professions are having huge vacancies right now, and wage is a big factor, and so we need to talk about the different ways that those organizations can be paying better, not just, you know, when people are first hired, but how do we keep people in those positions long term as well.
RMAPI has been pushing for a minimum wage of $15 an hour. What do support professionals make?
I can answer that, Dawson.
Yeah. Go ahead, Angie.
we just recently put up our wages to 15 this week. But before then, we're looking at really $13 an hour was the entry pay for positions. And actually, 13 is new to us. We went to 13 when the minimum wage raised in New York to $12.50. We wanted to be at least a quarter above. So you're really talking about some really low-paying jobs with high levels of responsibility for other human beings.
I'm sure there's no doubt a lot of stress, a lot of importance. I mean, these jobs are so important, and yet, Angie, you know, if you were to get an influx of funding, do you hire more people or do you raise wages of the people who are already working?
I will start by raising wages of the people who are already working. I think $15 is where we're trying to get to, but these jobs are definitely worth more than a $15 wage. So I think it's starting with the workforce that we have and stabilizing that workforce, because I think that also helps us bring other people that are passionate about serving this population into this field. I think is really, you know, when we're looking for jobs, we often talk to other people that are in similar roles, right? And if that workforce is not feeling like they're being that they're being valued or they're being compensated correctly or they're overworked or burnt out, I think that also has a lot of implications for how word of mouth gets around.
Rebecca, what's the order of operations as you see it? I mean, if we get more funding, how should it be used?
You know, I think from our MAPI's perspective, it's about $15 as the starting point. Mm-hmm. It's a minimum. And so how do we get everyone to that to start? And then how do we start having conversations about making sure that those jobs are really good jobs, that they are workplace cultures that are supportive, that they are inclusive, and that people, you know, aren't facing barriers to working in those jobs long term, that people have opportunities for career advancement. So we would see funding, you know, I think agreeing with Angie, the first step would be to get everyone to 15. And then how do we make sure those jobs are good jobs that people want to have long term?
Okay. What do you think, Marissa?
I agree with that. When you put together all the care professions, direct support professionals, certified nursing assistants, home health aides, that is the fastest growing industry in our country. And those folks are not making a livable wage. So when you fast forward, you end up with a significant majority of our working people not making a sustainable wage and needing to rely on public assistance. It's upside down.
This is money that generally, and again, I'm just trying to kind of get caught up to speed on where funding comes from. According to New York Disability Advocates, almost all the money that pays DSPs comes to agencies from government at various levels. What level typically, Marissa?
Medicaid, okay. Through the state level.
Through Medicaid, mm-hmm. It's the state. And all the data indicates that the starting rate is usually less than $15 an hour. Only a portion of the positions pay around $20 an hour. I mean, these jobs are tough. And I want to talk to Pat and Kevin about some of that work. And Pat, as a direct support professional with People Inc., I want to know about what you do. So take me through what your work entails.
Well, I've been in this field about 24 years. I started at $5 an hour.
$5 an hour.
And it's... I don't want to say it's about the money, because for what we do, it really isn't. The money is just not enough for what we do. My day starts at 8, and it's getting them up, showering them, letting them get in the shower, verbally prompting them, getting their breakfast ready, starting our dayhab. Our staff has, in the 8 years that I have been with People Inc., at this house I've been at for 6.5, I've seen a major, major staff turnover. They get burnt out. I mean, I have always done anywhere from 160 to 180 hours every 2 weeks. I'm going to be 64 next week, so that's a lot for an old lady. But you do what you got to do, because it's not our residents' fault that we don't have the staffing. People don't want to work for $12 or $13 an hour. Half of our staff have 2 full-time jobs because it's just not enough.
Do you get burned out?
I've learned to work on 4 hours sleep. 5 may be the most. I try to take 2 vacations a year. I go 6 weeks at a time. I save my PTO just to do that so I can go visit my kids and my grandkids. You do what you got to do, because the residents don't have anybody to go to. So they depend on you. You basically, they become more your family, because you're there more than your home. I'm home to sleep and shower. That's pretty much it.
Wow. When you started at $5 an hour in the 1990s, why did you take a job at $5 an hour doing that?
Because I was waitressing and there was no benefits. I used to make between $700 and $900 a week waitressing. But it was $2 an hour. I depended on my tips. I started to get older. I started this field when I was 40. Said I needed benefits. So a friend of mine says, well, why don't you try going working with people with disabilities? I said, what does that entail? Of? She said, basically helping somebody grow. I started with a company. I had a gentleman who could not write his last name. It took me 10 years to teach him how to write his last name. I worked there for 13 years. And it was such an accomplishment, such a joy, knowing that I taught this man to write his last name. That's all he wanted to do, because he could write his first name beautifully. He just couldn't do his last. And it was just a joy, and I've just stuck in this field since.
Do you love these folks?
I do. They call me Grams because I'm the oldest one in the house. They look at me as a mother figure. They'll come to me for advice, you know, personal advice, family advice, because they don't, a lot of them don't really have family, but they just get attached. You have compassion. You got to have patience, especially when you're so short-staffed.
What is the hardest part of the job?
Dealing with them when they lose one of their family members, because they get so emotional that they don't know how to express it, and you could see the change in them. The biggest thing is knowing them, knowing their warning signs, knowing when something bothers them or when they're upset. They have little vibes that they can send off, and you do get to learn your individuals, and that's the basics of trying to keep them relax and calm and bringing them into the community and showing them that there's more, because a lot of them have come from institutions and they do have a different life being in this kind of environment, that they get to go out, they get to go shopping, they get to go to the malls. They, you know, they do so much more now than they ever did before.
Are you assigned, Pat, to individuals? Are you assigned, you know, sort of to sections? I mean, how does your assignment work?
Every day we get a new sheet, so every day you get a different resident.
Okay.
So we just go day by day. We have a calendar that we follow of what they're going to do during day hab. So, like today, we were at the rec center. They walk the track. If they do 18 laps, that's a mile. Exercise, got to incorporate exercise. They're out to lunch right now, so after lunch we're going to the library. They look up things that they like to do. And then we try to incorporate it to the best of our abilities.
When you look at the scheduling now and the staffing issue that you talked about, I mean, when you say patience is important, it's got to be harder because everyone is doing more. You're
yes.
working longer hours. You've got less help.
Absolutely.
How difficult is it to sort of build up that reserve of patience?
You do, because you realize that you have to do what you got to do that's best for them, because they have feelings and they can sense it. You know, they know, you know, so we try to do the best of our ability to keep our patients, in which we do an amazing job at, because we are. I mean, I have a staff who just completed 201 hours in 2 weeks. That's a lot for one person, you know, but we all do the best we can to help out to the best of our abilities. You know, we go in with a smile. Some days are, most days are better than others. We have a few days that are a little chaotic, but we've learned to deal with it. We redirect, you know, we prompt, we do whatever we need to do to make the day to the best that we can.
What's your fear now with the situation with staffing? I mean, what's your biggest concern here, Pat?
In the turnover that I've seen, we have such amazing staff right now at our house. They are so amazing. I mean, they are there to help and assist and be there if you need anything. The fear of them leaving, because not only do the residents get effective, so do the other staff. You know, and we do get applicants. Does that mean they're going to stay? We never know until after the time, you know.
Sure.
Some might just see a behavior and say, nope, this isn't for me.
Well, I mean, and you're sort of, I think my read on it from what you're telling me is you're kind of the matriarch of the
yep.
staff there. They look to you probably for guidance. You have a lot of experience. So do you hear from staff members who tell you, I don't know if I can keep doing this, either because of the burnout or because of the pay?
I do hear a lot of it. And I always tell them, you know, you're all in your 30s. You got more of an advantage to go find something else than somebody who's 64. Doesn't matter how many experiences I do have. I am 64. They're going to look at me differently than they're going to look at you at 30. They're going to say, well, this person can give me 10, 20 years. This lady here, how many more years is she going to give me? So I said, you've got to find, you know, if this is your passion, you do what you got to do. But if you feel that you're getting burnt out, or and everybody does complain about the money, because for what we do, it's really not enough. And like I said, I started at $5 an hour for 24 years. This has been an ongoing battle for as long as I can remember. Everybody's been fighting for more money because our job does entail so much.
Yeah, so at the risk of saying something that sort of sounds like kind of trite pablum, it's real when I say this because I think of my own mother. You're not paid enough. Our society has very skewed ways of valuing work.
Yeah.
And when people are being pushed out of a job like this, or we can't even find people to fill positions, we are signaling what we value. And that's a real problem. I mean, my mother just got honored for 35 years of work, and she's much older than you, Pat, as a behavioral health aide. And she works in a school district with children with disabilities. And I didn't know until I was much older that she made less than $20 an hour, and she's made that for three decades because she doesn't have a teaching degree. And I couldn't believe it. I said, Mom, they're burn you out. And I think it shocks people to find out what this field can make or not make.
That's true because, you know, I raised three kids. The majority of it, I was a single mom. You know, my job was to provide for my children, you know. And as sad as to say, what little I was making, I made too much to get any assistance. You know, and it was like, okay, so, you know, we struggle a little harder. We do the best of our abilities, you know. And my boys used to keep saying, Mom, why do you do this? Mm-hmm. I said, you know, when I tell you I'm tired, it's because I'm tired. Until it was take your child to work day. And my boys saw what I did. And they were like, we will never bother you again when you tell us you're tired. And yeah, they said, Mom, yeah, they don't pay you enough to go through. And I said, no, but your heart. And he says, yep, that's you, your heart. Yeah. So it's my heart.
What's it been like during the pandemic?
A little harder because our dayhab was always, our dayhab consists of from 10 in the morning till 2:45 out in the community. With everything being shut down, it was creating, and thank God our team leaders, our managers were so creative that they created so many things for our residents to do in the house. Because they couldn't do anything else, you know. Families couldn't come, they couldn't go because it was still brand new, so they didn't know what was going on. But we got through it. You know, once we were able to go out, they were like a child in a candy shop. They just thought the world just opened up, you know, and they were just so excited because they're so used to doing so many things every day. You know, we usually have a program, our day have, like I said, consists from 10 to 3. And we have a morning thing that we do. Then they break for lunch, which is an hour. And then we continue a second half of dayhab. So they have two things to do on a daily basis, 5 days a week.
Throughout this conversation, I've watched Marissa Geithner has had these moments where she just smiles in recognition of the work here. I mean, there's many people like Pat. I'm sure you've gotten to know them in their stories over the years. They are amazing people. Again, I'm not trying to be patronizing. I am respecting and admiring it. And they're not paid enough, and there's probably not enough people. What happens, Marissa, if you can't fill more positions here? What are you worried about with people like Pat and her colleagues?
Yeah, I do. I have such admiration for Pat. I too started my career in direct support. We were talking about that earlier. What happens is what's happening already in some areas of the country. Programs are closing. Homes are doubling up. We're putting adults back in shared bedrooms in small homes. Programs like Pat speaks of, dehabilitation programs that really seek to get people out and active in their community, they go away. And we revert back to circumstances where people are away from community and people are in large congregate environments and nobody wins.
Angie Perez Delgado, who or what entity has the most power to change this soon?
Yeah, I think, you know, we need our partners at OPWDD to continue to advocate just strongly. Our rates need to change. We need to be reimbursed differently. And I think bring our staff faster into a living wage. And if I can add, a couple of weekends ago, I had a staff email me and say, I'm going into my second shift. The person who was going to relieve me has called off. I love Ibero. I have been here for 4 years, but I need to go home to my family. And I called my administrators and I said, you know, I have a staff reaching out. And they said, Angie, we have our management are on the floor. So I said, okay, I'll go. And I think it was the best thing for me to do to go because I got to see this wonderful staff who's dedicated their whole life. They need to go home. And it broke my heart, right? As the leader of this organization, it broke my heart that people have to make those kind of decisions. But I got to see firsthand. I mean, you know, I walked into a catheter being changed, someone being cleaned up, and I said to myself, you know, I don't even know if I could do this work, and I'm a master level clinician. So I think for me that was very eye-opening, and I think our partners in the state, you know, need to advocate strongly to make this happen for us. We have an opportunity to reinvent our rates and make sure that our staff are being compensated for the work that they're doing. Mm.
Rebecca Meyer, Project Administrator at RMAPI. I have a private note, so I won't read the name on this, but just a note from a listener who says this story is heartbreaking but needs to be told. And having an in-law in assisted living, the aides are angels that make minimum wage often. It's tragic. My wife actually gives some of the better aides cash as thanks almost weekly. Is unionization an option? How do we make this better? The turnover is terrible, wages are terrible, and reimbursement rates from the government to facilities is embarrassing. That's from a listener. It was a private note. I'm not going to read the name. But I think people are really moved by these stories. And Rebecca, where are the solutions as you see them?
Well, I think, you know, the solutions for today's conversation are, it's not just about direct support professionals. There's a lot of, Marissa mentioned, CNAs and home health aides. There's a lot of different positions where this is an issue. And the state reimbursement rates are a big part of that. Organizations like Ibero, like Heritage, receive funding through a variety of different state government, state offices. And, you know, if they're getting different types of reimbursements, different types of funding from one office versus another, it makes it really hard to have equitable pay for their employees. And so it's about state government and other government levels raising those rates so that these organizations can raise pay across the board and not have to have a patchwork of how to fund one position versus another. And it's also, you know, acknowledging that this is about addressing wage gaps in our community by race and by gender, that, you know, many of these people in these positions that we're discussing are women and are women of color. And so if we really want to impact, you know, structural racism and then those racial wage gaps in our community, we need to put a focus on increasing the money that goes towards these organizations. Mm.
Kevin Scott is a former direct support professional and now staff member at Ibero. Kevin, can you describe some of the work that you've done in your career?
Oh, wow. I pretty much worked the floor. I managed two group homes at a time. Just constantly being, you know, on the floor, assisting, whether it's cooking, you know, bathroom needs or, you know, any type of emotional or mental needs that I called for at the time, pretty much.
What did you, What did you feel or go through at the work in terms of, you know, in terms of burnout, in terms of strain? I mean, everybody kind of, as Pat mentioned, you know, more good days than bad, you hope, but everybody kind of goes through those. What was it like for you, Kevin?
You know, in the beginning, it wasn't a problem. But, you know, I know my endurance and I knew it was a need at the time. But the struggle became when, you know, I found myself pretty much living at work versus, you know, living at home. And especially, you know, I have two twin girls, and it was like I would rarely see them because of work or whether, you know, somebody called off and it's a mandation thing. And it's like, okay, you know, I have to raise my girls through FaceTime and what have you. And, you know, that started to become a conflict. They knew I had to work. And, you know, they understand the position, you know, that I was put in, you know, and I loved what I did. But it came time to where I had to make a difficult decision of, okay, is it work or do I have to continue to sacrifice home life? You know, just because of, you know, the things that are going on at home. So it was definitely tough, definitely tough.
What's going to be the most effective way to help? I mean, it sounds like it's raising the wage and adding staff. That's been sort of the refrain this hour. But, I mean, how do you see it happening and how accessible is this sort of a fix or an improvement here, Kevin?
Well, I would say all of the above. And then just, you know, just the lines of communication. You know, hey, this is what we're trying to work on, short-term goal, long-term goal. You know, this is what we're trying to work on. And then, you know, when that deadline comes, you know, either say, you know, we're almost there, we're not there, but just give some type of sign of communication. Because I'm thinking communication will instill some type of hope, you know, and it'll keep, you know, the DSPs holding on. Because, you know, I've seen DSPs and even myself to where you get a love, you know, for your individuals, you know, because they're like second family to you. And, you know, like when one DSP leaves, it'll affect the individual or, you know, even vice versa. That's just, you know, human nature. But I'm thinking clear, you know, communication will, you know, sit up here to at least try and help some things out.
Yeah, that is so important. I mean, there is dignity in all work, and there is importance in the human contribution to all jobs and work. But having said that, these are the kind of jobs where when somebody leaves, it's not just, well, plug somebody else in if you can find them. The human impact, as Kevin mentioned, is so significant. And you know, Pat, you were saying you were home. You've been home for 24 years to shower and sleep. I mean, it sounds like Kevin can relate to that. How much are you relating to Kevin's story here?
100%. Thank God for my mother, because she's the one that was my backup for my kids growing up.
Yeah.
Because I had to provide for them. And, you know, $5 an hour is
amazing.
Is not a lot of money when you got boys in sports and special. They want special name shoes and clothes, and you do what you have to do. And yeah, I basically just slept and showered.
That's amazing.
And I still do to this day because, you know, I had my knee replaced in March, March 15th. And the doctor says, you can go back July 15th. I went back June 1st because they were so short. I felt horrible.
I'm not surprised, yeah.
Because the individuals don't know that, you know, we're short. They're in a routine. They have a routine every day, and they know their routine. And,
yeah,
you know, you don't want to disrupt it for them to have a behavior. I mean, you want to keep everything as calm as the sea. You don't want to have a typhoon come through.
Absolutely. Kevin, Pat was mentioning that when her kids finally saw it up close, they really got it. Why she was tired sometimes or why she was away so much. Has your family, have your kids, did they come to get it over time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been doing this for, over 20 years. My girls, my twins, they're 16. So I would say for the past, 14 years that I've been here with Ibero, you know, they started to get it. You know, it was like I would come home and, you know, I would get the questions, Dad, how long are you going to be home this time? You know, because, you know, being a single father, those are things that, you know, you never thought you would have to answer. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, anybody on this call or anybody in this field pretty much never saw this coming.
No.
You know, especially with the pandemic, you know, that that's going on. And so, you know, it was like, okay, hopefully I'll be here for an hour or two or something like that. Then I had to rely on the supports of, you know, my mom and my dad. And, you know, they're senior citizens. They live their lives. So I started feeling, you know, bad for them. Even though they were there and still are there, you know, the toll, it would be difficult on some nights, but real difficult on others. You know, especially if you had to get a call at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and you had to go in because of, you know, natural causes, things that you can't control.
Yeah, crazy.
So, yeah, it was difficult.
Kevin, you talk about managing group homes. For people who have not spent time in a group home, what do you think they understand the least?
I would say the foundation. What I mean by, you know, the things that goes into a group home, the rules, the regulations, and the fact that, you know, when you, yes, exactly, the structure. And then the fact, too, that, you know, when you come into this type of system, you know, our individuals are already prejudged because of what's written down about them. And, you know, you won't get an actual understanding until you step across that line to see versus any and everything that you're hearing, because different relationships, you know, are formulated. Like, one person could like me better than the next person or vice versa, depending on that day.
Absolutely.
Pat, I was going to ask you the same thing. What do you think people really don't understand who've never done the kind of work that you do?
Exactly like he said, if you don't cross that line, you have to have that type of, I don't want to say personality, but that inner being, you know, because our residents have been judged from back to Geraldo and Willa, you know, in the institution that he opened wide. It's just amazing what you can accomplish, you know, putting your best foot forward. And, you know, my guys, my girls, two of the guys have already moved out and they're on their own, but they still call me and say, hey, Grams, what do you think of this? You know, I always tell them, because they always are in a hurry to get to the next day. And I said, you know, my grandfather, who lived to be 104, said to me, you can't get to tomorrow till today's over, because you never know what tomorrow's going to bring. And that's what I keep giving to my guys. You know, you're rushing for the end of the week because Friday might be a more exciting day than Monday, but you can't get there until we get through the rest of the day. So you do one day at a time. You can't, you know, and like you said, you know, it's a bond that you build. And he's right. There are some residents that might not like me today because I might have asked them to do something they don't want to do, but then tomorrow they'll love me to pieces. You know, especially when I go on vacation, they're like, I'm leaving for good. And it's like, no, I'm coming back. Unless I win the lottery, then I'll let you know. But otherwise, I'll be back. You know, I keep telling them I'm going to work till I'm 70. And my kids are like, are you crazy? What's wrong with you? This is your time to enjoy life. And it's like, no, I say 70, but your body tells you something different. So I just take it one day at a time.
Do you love that they call you for advice?
I do, because I feel that we have that kind of connection.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll tell them, I've lived a lot longer, seen a lot, done a lot more than you guys will ever see. So if I tell you something, it's not because I'm lying. It's because it's real life experience.
Well, judging by your grandfather, you got another 40 years to go here.
Well, I hope so. My mother's 88, got more energy than I do. So God bless them. Man.
All right. So before we lose the hour, I want to just make sure that our guests have a chance to leave all of us with, you know, we've been hearing exactly the state of the industry and what's going on in terms of staffing shortages, the struggles to fill these jobs, et cetera. And I just want to ask, I'll start with Marissa Geithner, who's president and CEO of Heritage Christian Services. You know, what do you want to leave people with? I mean, I don't know if you're advocating or if you want people to get out and advocate with you, but what needs to happen here?
Yeah, I thank you so much for offering us the opportunity to get some of those thoughts out. I appreciate what you said, Evan. The narrative needs to change in our country. We have just come through a time where there is no question the work is essential. Now it's time for us to step up and demonstrate that the people doing the work are essential and they deserve to make a livable wage. And I want to put a face to that. Right? In New York State, care professions, all of those professions that I mentioned, they're made up of 90% women, 77% people of color, and 60% immigrants. These are people that are working hard 200 hours in 2 weeks and still trying to make ends meet with the responsibilities they have. So I want to put a face to that. And it is time for us to step up and show our value in many ways in our country. And we don't want this value of care and compassion to be left. And then I just want to highlight the stories that you heard. This is meaningful work. This is rich work that people choose for a career against all odds, because it's powerful and meaningful work. And so we always want to leave people with that and welcome more people into this. And of course, with a more competitive wage, we stand a better chance of people being able to choose caring professions.
Angie, about 45 seconds. What do you think?
I would echo what Marissa says, just change the narrative. And I think you said it best in the beginning, right? We're going to focus on what we value. And I think it says a lot about the state of our country that we take roles like the DSP and devalue them by giving them low wage, knowing that these are critical components of our community and often communities of color and women. So I echo what you said in the beginning and what Marissa just said.
And Rebecca Meyer, Project Administrator at RMAPI, what do you think?
Yeah, I think this is about paying essential workers what they deserve to be paid. It's about addressing racial and gender wage gaps in our community. And we can't address poverty and we can't address childhood poverty if people working incredibly hard aren't paid for that work.
And because I've got 20 seconds, Rebecca, who sets the wages? Who's the first person who can change that?
Well, I might defer to Marissa on that, but I think for this profession, it would be the state and it would be the employers and the employers with the support of the state.
Okay. State legislature on reimbursement rates?
Absolutely.
Okay. State legislature has a lot to do there. And I know every budget's tight. Everybody's budget's tight everywhere. But it's hard to think about Pat and Kevin and all of their colleagues making what they make and doing the work they do. Thank you. Pat, thank you for the work that you do.
Welcome.
It's really great to meet you and to talk to you. Kevin, thanks for the work that you do. Wonderful talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you as well.
And Marissa Geithner, Angie Perez Delgado, Rebecca Meyer, thanks for the expertise and the time. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More connections coming up in a moment.